listening to the Animation Addicts Podcast, episode 69, Princess Mononoke. Go away.
Welcome to the Animation Addicts Podcast with the Rotoscopers, Disney, DreamWorks, Pixar, Don Bluth, Studio Ghibli, and everything in between. I am your host, Mason Smith. Good evening, everyone. And I'm here with Morgan Stradling, cool trainer extraordinaire.
Hey.
Well, fans, please excuse the amazing Chelsea Robson from this episode tonight. She is unavailable, but tonight we have a special guest who has never before appeared on the Animation Addicts Podcast, and that is our very own Rotoscopers writer, Myra Maya.
Hi, guys. Roto Writer, I believe, is our new title.
Yes.
Roto Writer. Yes, put that on her luggage.
So, actually, you know how last week we were talking about our accomplishments that we had done in the past month, you and me, Mason, finishing school and whatnot, and Chelsea's like, yeah, just doing what I do. Well, yesterday, Chelsea got to go to the Country Music Awards. It's kind of a big deal. So, Chelsea, put that on your list and check it off.
Well, did she go, like, as an attendee, or did she perform at it?
As an attendee. That would be ridiculously cool.
Someday, right?
Although she did, Lindsay Sterling was a presenter, and Chelsea knows Lindsay, and so she texted her. And
I also, I talked to Lindsay, like, 5 times.
Well, yeah.
I was the ward executive secretary, so I, like, saw her in the hall a few times.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, cool. What was Lindsay Sterling doing at the CMT Awards? Oh, well.
Exactly.
They sure are branching out. Well, awesome. Well, so we will have to excuse Chelsea because she's on this amazing country crusade. This is going to be like one of those Prince John quoting episodes. I just know it.
Mm-hmm.
Myra, I hope you're ready because this can be pretty intense with our Disney quotes.
I'm ready for you guys to quote. I'm actually a terrible, terrible quoter. Worst memory ever. Long-term big ideas I capture and I have. The quotes, not so much.
Awesome. Well, we are definitely going to enjoy having you on the show because this film that we are reviewing today is a Studio Ghibli Miyazaki masterpiece that has a lot of big ideas, and so you are just the person that we need on this episode, Myra.
I am so excited.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Myra is our resident Studio Ghibli expert and fan extraordinaire. So when we were thinking about this episode, I'm like, perfect, this is the girl we need to have, so welcome.
Absolutely, absolutely. And speaking of fans, the fans were in like a positive uproar when I tweeted that we were doing this movie, more so than any other like film that I announced on social media, at least on mine. And so our fans feel very passionately about this movie, and it's very popular, and as I'm sure you already know, we are doing the 1997 Studio Ghibli masterpiece, Princess Mononoke.
Everybody, I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends, so for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcasts, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watching on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
Keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Brav Bros, two guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude, stop with the voice. Just keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're two dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Brav Bros.
Good job.
I remember seeing a preview for this on some Disney movie. It was a Disney movie, and then there was a preview for Princess Mononoke. And if you ask me, I can imagine the title. I don't remember what it was, but it probably said something like, you know, it's a story about a pig, a demon pig, and a boy who's infected by a demon. That's right. It's not a Disney film. It's a Disney distributed film. And the subject matter is so un-Disney at times that I kind of watching this movie recently to gear up for the podcast, I was like, wow, do we really want to do this movie? Because it's very mature. I think it's probably the most mature, like, content-wise that we've reviewed so far.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of the violence, you know? From Studio Ghibli, partnering with Walt Disney Animation, it's a story about people's arms getting shot off.
Yeah, this movie, I'd only seen it one time before, and so I forgot how violent it was, I guess. And so the very, very first scene is very intense. And so when there was a literal arm being chopped off and all the flesh being shown, I was like, whoa, what have I gotten myself into?
Excellent, excellent. And we've got a ton of cool stories about the production and the distribution of this film. But parents, be warned, if you are listening, you won't find anything that's not clean on this podcast, but just know that Princess Mononoke is not a film for young children. Heads will roll. People will lose their limbs. There's blood and ooze. There's a lot of ooze in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree? All right, so let's take you guys back. Original release date for Princess Mononoke was the 12th of July, 1997. And I'm always blown away by the release dates of these films that we review because I'm like, was it really 1997? I first watched this in high school. I didn't get all the way through it, but I completed it recently for this podcast. So just to give you all an idea, other films from 1997 were Don Bluth's Anastasia, also Hercules, Beauty and the Beast, The Enchanted Christmas, Mighty Ducks the Movie, which was an animated film, Cats Don't Dance, Pooh's Grand Adventure, the most depressing animated movie ever made, and also The Swan Princess 2. That one's for you, Morgan. And also The Land Before Time 5. So by the time this movie was made, there had already been 5 Land Before Time movies. That's always a good, milestone, benchmark for a movie. Oh, by this time, how many Land Before Time movies were there? Oh, they were still in the first dozen. 93% on Rotten Tomatoes. So certified fresh. This is a hugely successful Japanese animated movie. Intended to be Miyazaki's final film before retiring. You know, the first of five times he said he was going to retire. That's a joke. It did so well that it led him to make Spirited Away. So for that, I thank you, Sensei Miyazaki, because without this film, we would not have Spirited Away, which a lot of people consider to be Miyazaki's magnus opus, or however the heck you say that. According to some facts I found on the web, this is a monumental film for many reasons. For 1997, it was the second longest animated film ever made. It was also the last major animated motion picture to be filmed on plastic animation cells, as opposed to digital cell, compositing and stuff. And as of 1997, it was the most expensive anime ever produced. How about that, folks? And the production of the film is quite a tale. We have a lot of awesome information on the production of this film. Very interesting.
So in terms of the production of Princess Mononoke, I actually ran to my local bookstore and purchased both parts of Miyazaki's biography, which pretty much go movie by movie that he's ever made. And gives all of the material that surrounds that specific movie, everything from a mock-up of the production notes that he gave as a proposal to the studio so that they would give him permission to make the film, as well as, like, poems, interviews that he did after the film was released in Japan as well as in the U.S. Well, he never came to the U.S., but interviews that he did with, like, Ebert and other critics. In the proposal, specifically, he talks a lot about the battle between humans and ferocious gods. That's actually the first or the second section of, I forgot to name the book. The first one is Starting Point, 1979 and 96. The second one is Turning Point, 1997-2008. So we start off with Turning Point. And in it, he talks about the battle between humans and ferocious gods. He talks a lot about the historical context of Princess Mononoke. He actually did set it in a very specific historical period in Japan, which is called the Muromachi period, which was from 1336 to 1573. So it's very specific to that era of Japan, with obviously a lot of fantasy, as most Studio Ghibli films do incorporate so much fantasy. He does illustrate and say exactly what the purpose of him making this film was. He is quoted in the book saying, "I am not attempting to solve the entire world's problems. There can never be a happy ending in the battle between humanity and ferocious gods. Yet even amidst hatred and carnage, life is still worth living. It is possible for wondrous encounters and beautiful things to exist. I will depict animosity, but that is in order to show the fact that there is something more precious." And that's just a small little bit of flavor of what he said in that section of the book. And there are 200 pages dedicated to Princess Mononoke alone, so it's quite a vast amount of information to process. He also really wanted to explore the iron workers in this film, because most of Japanese period films actually depict either the samurai or the villager perspective. So there's only those two dichotomies that are explored in Japanese live-action films as well as anime. So he really wanted to look at the people who are often left in the peripheral vision of Japanese historical films. Oh, he also, he wanted to explore this idea that he encountered while doing a lot of research for this specific film, that a lot of demons and spirits that have been passed down through the generations of Japan come from actual incidences or accidents that happen surrounding the area. For example, Princess Mononoke, she has those tattoos on her face because there was a legend pertaining to a girl who had burn marks on her face. So instead of making them more so burn marks, he made them tattoos a little bit more deliberate. Or for example, in Japanese legends overall, there's also the tale of a young Cyclops boy who, like, torments certain regions, and that comes from an iron worker who probably got his eye poked out at some point.
Cool. So really going into, like, not just the history, but also the mythology, you know, the kind of demonology or spirits of Japanese culture. That's really cool.
I'm, like, really interested to read those books. Because there's so many books about Walt Disney that people have read and written over the years, and different biographies of other major players in the film industry, but Miyazaki's huge and still around. So, I mean, that's really interesting. And, like, super dedication on your part from going out and buying the books. I must bow down to you, Omira.
Oh, thank you. No, I had been looking for these books for, like I've been looking at them for a couple of years now, and I'm just like, I was looking for that opportunity to buy them, and I was like, you know what, this is perfect time. I'm just going to do it. And the weird thing is, and this is a little nitpicky thing, but one of them is hardcover, and that's Turning Point. That's the book that has Princess Mononoke. And the softcover one is the first half, and it really bugged me, but it's because they're actually reprints since they were both released in 2008, and it's been so long. But it's such a nice collection of just all of this information that, honestly, I don't even know that they've compiled anything like this for anyone like, you know, Walt Disney or any of the other major studios. Sure, you have the art books, which goes into, you know, the details of, you know, how things were constructed and all that sort of thing. But this is, like, his actual words and ideas and what went into each and every single choice that he made for the film, which I think it's freaking awesome. I didn't even get through the entire chapter for Princess Mononoke, but I read like 130 pages in the last few days. So
great. Thanks for doing your homework.
You're welcome.
Okay,
my pleasure.
Okay, so Okay, so Miyazaki is passionate about his films, but it's obvious that he was really passionate about this film. I've been gathering some information on the production. Apparently, he personally supervised over every single cell of the film. That's 144,000 total cells, folks. And he also ended up redrawing 80,000 of them. 80,000! So, I don't know, should you call it micromanaging when it works so well?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, if you're a type A personality, avoid working for Miyazaki in his studio because, yeah, you're going to have someone hovering over you and nitpicking. And, you know, of course, it's the master, it's the legend, but might not go over too well. And, you know, in Japanese culture, I think having him be kind of a dominant personality over everyone, it seems like it would work.
Yeah, totally. I can't even imagine working for the guy. Can't even imagine.
Come on, use your imagination.
Ow, it hurts. So, I mean, there's more, folks. Apparently, he even went so far as to create a whole new kanji character, like a Japanese language character, to write his preferred title for the film, which was The Legend of Ashitaka. It was very Legend of Zelda. Actually, this film has a lot of Zelda in it. So that would have been cool if... I think it would have been less... people would have been less confused with The Legend of Ashitaka than Princess Mononoke.
Interesting.
That's my opinion, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I kind of explained that thing in the beginning, but, and actually, what's really nice about a lot of the work that Miyazaki did was he wrote poems for a lot of the main characters, like the forest spirit and Yaku, the red elk. He wrote this poem specifically for Joe Hisaishi, who is his lifelong music composer, so that he could get better insight into what those characters' musical themes were going to be throughout the film.
Mm-hmm. Can't even imagine. Can you imagine? Do directors have, like, this pill that they take that, like, lets them not sleep for, like, 5 years so they can, like, put so much work into stuff?
Yeah.
Well, he pretty much lived at the studio, and he neglects his family the whole time. So, you know, that's the pill. Neglect your family.
Yeah, I guess so. All right. Let's talk some distributor drama. As you probably know, the film was distributed by Miramax, which is related to Disney somehow. I don't understand it. But Miramax ended up demanding that edits be made for the American theatrical release of the film, given the violent content that was unbecoming of a movie with Disney's name attached to it, apparently. Now, a producer, Toshio Suzuki, sent Miramax a katana sword. A bloody katana sword. I'm just kidding. with a note attached that read, "No cuts." Thinking of Edna Mode. No cuts! But Disney/Miramax... they ended up agreeing to keep an unedited version of the film for the American theatrical release. But they only released the film in a handful of American theaters, since they controlled the distribution. And then they expressed their surprise when the film didn't fare very well in the box office, at least at first. Scandalous! But despite Disney's best efforts, the film ended up being the year's highest-grossing film in Japan, and by 2001 it was the top-selling anime in the U.S., following its VHS/DVD release. So that's pretty cool, because it didn't do well at first, but it was kind of like a sleeper hit once it hit video. But, you know, in the end, I don't really blame Disney for making the request for an edited version. And I don't understand, like, was Miramax supposed to edit it, or was that on Studio Ghibli's side? I don't know. And then doing some damage control when they ended up having to keep that promise, because, I mean, it is Disney. They have an image to keep up. But I am very glad that the American dubbed version of the film is unedited, as far as I can tell. I don't know if there were any content edits made.
No, those are the video that we see now is pretty much the video that they shot and did originally.
Yeah.
Which is nice. Also, just a little bit of trivia. You know what film finally toppled this film as number one in Japan?
Ghost in the Shell.
No.
Final Fantasy.
Spirited Away. Nope.
It's not anime?
No, it's not anime.
Well, that's no fun. I don't know. Titanic?
It was Titanic.
Oh, sweet. I win. Smith wins. Hey, good job. Me? Well, all right. Well, okay, that's very cool. So Titanic finally beat Princess Mononoke. But by just a smidge, right?
I'm not sure on the numbers, but I would hope so, just a smidge. That was a really weird cultural undertaking. I don't know. That was weird when that happened. Miyazaki said so himself. He was like, that was really strange.
So one thing when you first hear this movie, you look at the cover, and it gives you something very Japanese. A lot of times it's, kind of a warrior-ish holding a sword, or it's very, violent, and then you see the title Princess Mononoke, And as an American, that kind of, anytime you hear the word princess, it kind of puts a certain connotation in your head and an expectation. Maybe this is a fairy tale or whatever. And it is kind of like a mystical story, but it's not, if you're going in thinking you're getting a princess, a Japanese princess story, this is way different. Because it's not even that she's a princess. She's just, like, there's no kingdom involved or anything typical that you would expect. So I just would love to see what people's reactions are, you know, seeing just the title and the cover and then actually watching it. Like, whoa, what did I just get into?
I'm not going to lie. When I used to see the title without seeing the movie, the cover without seeing the movie, I thought that Ashitaka's image on the box art was Princess Mononoke.
I wasn't too tripped up on the whole princess thing. I don't know what it is, if I just, like, ignore titles all the time, or if I just ignore information people give me, and I just sit there and try to take a lot of the whole thing in. But, I mean, considering the idea that a lot of what Miyazaki was working with thematically in the film was a lot about legends mm-hmm. and, like, really big, broad ideas, it kind of makes sense that, you know, the Princess Mononoke was more so of a legend within the story that they were telling. You know, later on we do sort of put the pieces together that maybe it was San who they were talking about in the legend, but it's not directly associated because it's part of the legend, which I appreciate the ambiguity.
Well, I thought some characters referred to San as Princess Mononoke right before she attacks Irontown. I think they mentioned the name once in the film.
Yeah, they mention it at the beginning when they explain that whole thing. I think she's more like I said, a little bit more of an allusion to this legend. That's my guess. That's my take. Hmm.
At any rate, the whole story of this film is very complex, and it makes for a very long film. Like they said, it was the second longest anime as of 1997.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Yeah, this is one thing that as I was watching it, I was like half hour into it, and I'm like, wow, we've been watching a lot of movie. A lot of stuff has happened. It's been very dense. Like, we must be over halfway done. And I'm like, whoa, we're just 30 minutes into it? We're only a quarter of the way done? Okay, let's go back. And so, you know, finished watching the rest, and, you know, an hour into it, I'm like, all right, this has to be wrapping up. And I'm like, what? We're only halfway done? It was like, I don't know. It just, like, never ended. And it wasn't, like, bad. Like, I was, like, anxious for it to get over. It just, like, so much was happening, and there were so many characters and situations and legends and mysticism. It just kind of, it's really intense. And don't watch this movie late at night laying down on the couch because you will fall asleep even though you are totally engaged. It's just, yeah, it's just a lot to take in.
Very strange, very strange. But it's a beautiful, very epic story. Just a comment on that. I felt the same way about The Wind Rises, but for different reasons. I was mm-hmm. just sitting there in the theater, and I was like, nothing is happening. but I don't know. I guess that film just wasn't for me.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
512 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
We are the real Brady Bros. Brady Brothers from the TV show Brady Bunch. I'm Barry Williams.
And I'm Christopher Knight.
I played Greg, and who are you again?
I played Peter.
We've decided that we're going to do a podcast around episodes of the Brady Bunch. We're going to use it as a prism to look back to our experience doing the show and why the Brady Bunch is so popular.
Have a sunshine day.
We are the real Brady Bros.
Okay, we open with a very ominous, very dark prologue. Sludge Beast. Sludge boar thing. An exiled prince. A race against time. You know, going back to sludge, there is a lot of Fern Gully-ish sludge in this film.
Yeah, that's another thing. From the very beginning, you're introduced to this very obscure, weird sludge thing, and you're not quite sure what it is, and there's these tentacles. It's one of those things, again, what have I gotten myself into? What is going on? And I kind of like that it's very jarring when you're first watching this, and you're, like, trying to hold on to anything to try and root yourself to what's happening in the story. But, you know, you don't get that at the very beginning, and it really throws you in the moment.
So I could totally ruin that mystery for you if you really wanted me to.
Please ruin it.
So I guess the idea behind having the wormed things coming out of the boar and all of the other characters that it ended up taking over, it's Miyazaki's personal experience and interpretation of rage ever since he was really young. Whenever rage or serious deep felt anger would happen to him, that's literally how he would feel. He would feel like sort of, he has this physical reaction where he feels worms and things crawling on his skin and bursting out. It's really graphic, really weird. And for the longest time, he actually thought that most people had this reaction to rage. And it was only once he started talking to the younger animators that he realized that that's in fact not true.
People don't react like this.
The worm thing never really happened to me when I get angry.
I mean, I think I felt, you know, I think it's a different interpretation of maybe Goosebumps and maybe just more intense. I don't know. I've tried to wrap my brain around it. I don't think I've ever had this wormy feeling myself either.
Very visual.
Okay, interesting. Well, your explanation makes perfect sense because right after that, the village elders explain how the boar was consumed by rage and hate, having been wounded by this horrifying new technology that the humans have.
Yeah, so what I really like about Miyazaki's films and specifically is that he does take these really great themes and then explores them in a really nice visual sense. And he takes it on as a responsibility to make it the core theme of the film so that he could express it to children or to his audiences, which is really nice. And you see it multiple times throughout this film. Like you said, you know, the villagers talk about it, that the boar has that rage inside of him. Ashitaka, that's exactly what he's fighting the entire film, is his own anger at the curse that's been bestowed upon him.
Yeah, totally. And the dim-wittedness of those around him. Actually, it's just the stubbornness of everyone in the film except for him. Which brings us to Ashitaka. What a guy. He is the link of this film. Just heart of gold. Okay, I don't care if people hate me for this, but can someone please make a guide on how to tell if an anime character is a guy or a girl? I really could not tell until Ashitaka spoke.
Yeah.
But the Mulan-style dramatic hair, and I'm not the only one, and our listeners know it, but the Mulan-style dramatic haircutting helped a lot for me.
Ah, yes. I loved that scene. I thought it was very real. You know, the customs of our clan, you have broken, you are a prince, we don't care, you must follow this ritual, cut off your hair, and we will never speak to you again, goodbye. Very harsh, you know, to the point, but they are strict in their observance of their rules and their laws, and I really liked that. And he accepted it, there wasn't anger or anything, it was just, I must go now.
Yeah, I love the purity of his village in juxtaposition to Irontown, the samurai, and the forest creatures. It's there's a lot of diversity as far as culture and attitude towards life in the film, which I really like. So Ashitaka goes on this epic quest to solve his curse, you know, because of trouble in the West. It's always the West that's to blame. And he runs into our next main character, Jigo, the greediest monk ever. He's probably my favorite character, possibly tied with San or whatever, you know, Princess Mononoke or San. And he's voiced by Billy Bob Thornton. I was blown away.
Oh, my gosh. Like, I was watching this with Jared, but he was not really paying attention. He was kind of, like, on his phone. And
what? Jared always pays attention during viewings.
And then he just, like, perked up, and he's like, is that Billy Bob Thornton? And I'm like, let me double-check Google, IMDb. I'm like, yeah. He's like, that's weird.
I couldn't tell until I IMDb'd him, and I was like, it is Billy Bob Thornton. I knew he sounded familiar. That's probably why I like him so much.
How do you feel about that casting?
Oh, dude. Okay, normally I don't like a lot of casting for animes, but I thought Billy Bob Thornton was this, like, runaway hit. It was like a perfect – it was like a slam dunk home run for this film. Because, I don't know, I just like his voice because it really fits, like, the swindler, fast talker, mercenary, ruthless, opportunist – and yet, super cool, calm, and collected nature of this character. Like, Jigo never breaks his smile in the whole film. Like, he's almost never surprised, never upset, never disappointed. He just knows how to adapt to every situation for his own personal gain. And I know that's rotten, but that's why I like his character so much. He's like this weird, optimistic mercenary who's out to get rich, and he doesn't care what he has to do it. you know?
What's really weird, I enjoyed his character a lot, too, and I particularly enjoy his shoes.
Oh, his shoes are amazing!
They are amazing. They're like 10 inches tall.
I mean, that guy's calf muscles have got to be phenomenal.
But a lot of the animators would actually question me a second. Not only the animators, but actually a lot of the during the press junkets and just in talking with critics, a lot of people would ask Miyazaki about this guy's motivations and who he worked for exactly, because that whole thing is a little convoluted between him and Lady Eboshi, who exactly is the higher pyra there and who they're working for. And he actually ended up telling the animators to think of it in sort of the social structures within Studio Ghibli, where, like, you know, Miyazaki's there and he's giving the orders and the animators don't really know what direction ultimately he's going in, and they just sort of have to trust him and just do his bidding for him. So I thought that was really funny.
How it works over there.
Hey, he's just a modest monk trying to get by.
Exactly.
Lie! Yeah, I like him a lot. And I always like the duo of the very talkative, like, fast talker, and then the person who doesn't really want to talk, you know. So, mm-hmm. Ashitaka and Jigo. And then, you know, a lot of characters kind of swarm together in this kind of, you know, mini battle with the Wolf Clan versus Lady Eboshi and her Iron People. Mm-hmm. And we get to the iconic moment of the film where Ashitaka first meets San. The iconic moment, people. All the posters are of this moment. And actually, I know that the American posters have the image of San glaring at Ashitaka from across the river, only they censor it and they take off the blood on her face. But the Japanese poster has this amazing image of San glaring at the camera with blood all over her face. I love it.
It's totally my favorite part of the film. And it's... I have a lot of qualms about, you know, animation stories overall, and I think that's evident in some of my past articles.
By the way, if you have not checked out Myra's articles, you have to, because I'm going to include a link that just are any of her articles and her articles only, because she's very passionate. She's very polarizing. She doesn't kind of have the mainstream opinion, which is such a breath of fresh air.
She has written some of the most controversial posts on rotoscopers.com, yeah. as much as you can say on our website. But
yeah.
Although Gary just won me out. He just got an article with 145 hits on it, comments on it at the bottom, which I thought
Was that Tangled versus Frozen?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
Yep. Actually, everyone was really respectful in the comments.
Yeah, it was good. So definitely check out rotoscopers.com for all your great animation debates led by Myra and others.
Yeah, and you'll actually see how polarizing I am at the end when we rate this movie, and everyone's going to be like, what? But anyways.
Ooh.
Yeah, mystery.
Oh, wow.
Stay to the end, everybody.
Something to look forward to, everybody. Stay to the end.
So, cool. Yeah. This moment is honestly probably the most impactful part for me of the entire film. Personally, I feel like when San, she's pulling out the poison out of the wolf's wound on the side, and she turns around, and it's almost like Ashitaka is witness to her naked essence. And, like, this is San, no ifs, ands, or buts about it. It's not clouded. It's nothing. She's just standing there, and that is her. Unlike a lot of other stories that take this very romanticized version of falling in love at first sight, this is both gruesome and beautiful because it is real and it is honest and it is San. So that is why, yeah, I love this part.
I love their first interaction together. Hello, stranger. I'm coming to the... I want to know who the Forest Spirit is. Go away.
So romantic.
I love it.
That used to be my catchphrase in elementary school. I have a really sad story. So, like, I used it as sort of, like, just I had nothing better to say. I wanted to be kind of a little snarky brat. And so, like, I had this friend and these two guy friends, and they were super cool, and I really liked them. And we played Zelda together where we drew Triforces on our hands and pretended that we each had the different Triforce of courage. Anyway, one day, one of these guys was kind of a troublemaker, and I kept, like, yelling at him, like, go away, just go away. And one day he did go away. He got transferred to another school for bad behavior, and I always felt bad because I told him to go away.
It wasn't you. You didn't cause him to perform bad behavior.
I know. I just thought it was ironic. My last interaction with him was, go away, and he's gone.
Ah, well. Sorry. So you can't have a Studio Ghibli film without cute little spirit creatures. I like the little forest spirits. I like that they're children, you know, kind of innocence of the forest kind of thing. And we get some cool scenes because Ashitaka's taken upon himself to rescue these wounded soldiers or wounded dudes, because there aren't a lot of male soldiers in Irontown besides the big pushover dude with the giant samurai sword. I've noticed that Miyazaki has literally mastered the art of 2D cinematography and composition. Like, he is totally in control of the image, and rightly so. He redid 80,000 drawings in this film. But one iconic scene that I really like is the zoom in through the forest. Everything's super quiet. You know, slow zoom in until we see deer, and then we see not a deer, but the grand forest god spirit thingy, which is beautiful and creepy at the same time. It's very, very Miyazaki. And, you know, after that, you know, we get to Irontown, which is this stark contrast to the forest, and we are introduced to Lady Eboshi.
Who is personally my favorite out of all of them. Throughout Miyazaki's interviews and all of the material that I read, he keeps referring to her as like the representation of the woman of the 21st century, because she is very headstrong and she is very much her own person. And, you know, she, yes, there is a higher power that she does answer to, but she has her business, which is Irontown. She makes iron, she makes weapons. And I love the fact that she is the one that works with marginalized people, like the ladies of the brothels and their husbands who are ox drivers, which, again, there's a lot of information in the books about what that exactly means, because those two groups, both the brothel ladies, obviously, and the ox drivers, were very marginalized, both in historical or period set films, as well as in historical documentation. So I love the fact that she sort of straddles this both major themes that you know, the entire film focuses on, which is nature and making them dollar bills, y'all. Making them dollar bills.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, so yeah, definitely not totally good nor evil. And talk about a character who does not show her true form or true spirit when we first meet her. She's a very mysterious character. Also, art direction-wise, her character is physically large. Like, her character frame is tall and large. But you can see this a lot when – you can see it the most when San has a showdown with Lady Eboshi right before Ashitaka comes in and stops the whole thing. She is a very, like, imposing figure. And that makes total sense that she's a vision of the 21st century woman. you mentioned the ladies of Irontown. I think they're hilarious.
Yeah.
All sassy hookers with a heart of gold, as it were. I love the ensemble dialogue amongst the people of Irontown. I think it's awesome. It reminds me of Seven Samurai by Kurosawa.
Actually, that was one of his biggest influences for this entire film.
Cha-ching.
I'm, like, so excited that you said that.
Yeah.
And that film does exactly what he was actually trying to point out and not do. You know, Seven Samurai has the samurai and the village people. This film deals with everyone else. But a lot of the context is derived from that film. That's crazy.
Well, you know, like, everybody takes from Kurosawa. But but definitely, especially the scene where Ashitaka's sitting and eating with the men of the village, and they all have this banter, this, like, dialogue, and everything's very, like, very irreverent, you know? It reminds me exactly of that scene in Seven Samurai where the dude is playing the lute or the harp or whatever, and these guys are, like, just BSing in this pub. And it reminded me exactly of it. And I don't know why, but I freaking love the scene where Ashitaka tries his hand at working the giant bellows in the ironworks, and all the ladies are, like, so thrilled to have, like, a useful man around. They're like, whoa, he's so cool.
See, that's a lesson to all men out there. If you just help around the house or just be a good boyfriend, you know, the girls appreciate it. It's a big deal.
What do we want? A girl worth fighting for. But the ladies love a man in armor. Yeah, totally. Oh, also, Lady Eboshi has this right-hand thug man, Gonza. I think he's brilliant.
Oh, he's totally like Sokka from... Did I say his name?
Sokka?
Sokka. Oh, it's been a while.
Yeah.
Like, everything about him is Sokka from The Last Airbender. He's just sort of like the goofy sidekick. He's hilarious. He has a little ponytail thing.
Big, obnoxious pushover that no one has respect for.
Basically.
He has like big guy syndrome. You know how some people have little guy syndrome? He has big guy syndrome. He thinks he demands a lot of respect, but he gets none. Heaven bless him.
Gosh, there's so many characters in this movie. But
really are. What a cast.
But it's like all of them are memorable and all of them fit in the space that are needed for.
And he was voiced by John DiMaggio with it, which I think was a obscure but a really effective move. He voices Jake in Adventure Time, and he's also Bender on Futurama, my personal favorite. And I just think it's a good choice. I think Jada Pinkett Smith also did a voice in this film.
Guys.
I think she was the Iron Town lady, right? The head wife or whatever.
She was like the head brothel lady.
Yeah, yeah.
Her voice was so off for me. Like, the minute she spoke, I'm like, you don't belong in this universe. You are too, like, sassy of a woman. She took me out of the character. I thought it was horrible casting, really removed me from the plot, and I just, like, every time she talks, I'm like, I know, not you again, because you don't match what you should be. But did you guys feel that way?
I really didn't feel that way, but I do love Toki's character because she, like, does not respect her husband at all.
There we go.
Yeah. I wasn't too bothered by her, but I was... Okay, so I've been watching Studio Ghibli films for a while. My first one was Kiki's Delivery Service, but that's beside the point.
Classic.
I do kind of feel like in terms of character design, they sort of do recycle a lot of the same silhouettes and basic details of all of the characters.
Yeah.
Which is totally okay, I think. But it's just funny to note, you know, like I thought the old wives woman at the beginning of Princess Mononoke looked a lot like old Sophie from Howl's Moving Castle, or even the old lady from Kiki's Delivery Service, or like the rice lady in Princess Mononoke also looked like Ursula from Kiki's Delivery Service. Everything's going to go back to Kiki's Delivery Service. But I don't know. It kind of bothers me, but when you're watching it, when I'm watching it, it doesn't really bother me too much. But I just thought it'd be a nice little tangent.
It is a great tangent, because Ashitaka does look a lot like Aku from Spirited Away.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, if Ashitaka had just turned into a dragon and killed everyone that needed to be killed, this film would have been over so quickly. Well, Aku's not really violent as a dragon.
No, I guess he was the one who got attacked with all of the...
With the evil paper airplanes?
Yeah, the evil paper airplanes.
I'll have to go back to Miyazaki's book to, like, figure out all the symbolism in that film. Boy, that we should almost do a whole nother episode with you, Myra, and get the lowdown on what everything means.
Oh, I would love to. That's that's the thickest one of them all. It's just so juicy. There's so many layers. I spend hours on that.
You know, speaking of thick, and this is just my opinion, I think the movie could almost be divided into two films because it's just so long. The first film ending with Ashitaka leaving Irontown with San after the duel with Eboshi. And what a ferocious duel. Like, San with a knife she is nuts. Watch out, people. Out of her way. And then the moment of Gonza is like, you're never going to get past me, punk. And Ashitaka just kind of walks past calmly and bends his sword around with one hand. And Gonza's like, huh? Girl.
You know, you were talking about how this movie could be split into two films. If this were made today, you know, nearly 20 years, 15 years later, maybe it would be, because there is a disturbing trend in cinema today where they split unnecessarily movies into two parts,
which disturbing.
I have even heard recently that How to Train Your Dragon 3 potentially could be split into two parts and making it 3 and 4. And I'm like, no, don't move into animation.
At 2 DreamWorks.
Yeah,
well, yeah, that's just lame. I mean, think, if they had finished Mockingjay when Philip Seymour Hoffman was alive. Anyway, that's besides the point. But it's totally the thing that they would totally... You're totally right, Morgan. They would have totally split it up into two.
Well, except for this is Miyazaki, and he would have had the brains to say, no, we're just making it two-plus hours.
That's exactly what I was going
to
say.
He would have mailed, like, a severed hand to the distributors being like, no cuts!
Anyway. Yeah, he would not have been okay with any Americanized, you know, cuts just for the sake of making more money.
Yeah, totally. So finally, Ashitaka is kind of, he's like in with San. He almost didn't make it, because as soon as he fell off that horse, that wolf came to chew on his head, which I think is funny for some reason. And we're introduced to different, and he goes from the human world to the world of the forest. Like, yes, he did get a glimpse of the forest god spirit guy thingy earlier in the film, but in this one he gets totally entrenched in the world of the forest. And so we're introduced to the ape tribe. poor apes and poor pigs. They don't really get it. Stubborn and ignorant. But it's probably because they're losing their powers because of the human's influence. I like that cool relationship, that the more powers the human gain, the more hapless the forest gods become. It's really interesting.
So what are the different types of forest gods that we're introduced to?
Okay, so we've got the little forest spirits. I don't think they count as gods. And I don't know if even the apes count as gods.
They're just spirits.
The pigs seem like warfare gods. Because they don't really seem to have anything on their mind other than, you know, destroy all humans, and that warfare will solve all their problems. Mm-hmm. And I think the pig tribes, the boar tribes, sorry, boars, not pigs, I think their story is very tragic. What's the name of the leader of the boars, the one that's alive?
I don't remember.
Otako.
Too many names, I can't remember.
Otako?
Is it Otako?
Especially when they're mentioned once.
Here we go.
Yeah, just call him Otako. That sounds Japanese and legit.
No, I'm not going to
Taco.
Now it just sounds Spanish to me, because it sounds like tacos.
Oh, tacos. Okay, here we go, Princess Mono, and that's all I need. Princess Mono. Let's see. Okoto. Right. So Okoto is this giant elder boar. And he sees that Ashitaka is telling the truth, that there is a curse, and that hatred will make it worse and eventually consume everyone. But his story is so tragic because he's like, well, look, the humans have gained so much power that my men or my soldiers are stupid now. They're mindless. All they have on their minds is to kill the humans. And I don't care if we do die in this battle, because we have this pride to defend. And he seems less stubborn than the rest of the boars. You know, the boars are just like, you know, kill the humans, kill the humans. And, Okoto is, I don't know. I have deep respect for him, but he is a very tragic character. His story is just kind of crazy in the end, but you know, the pigs and their pride, you know, I guess that's that it's a message in the film that warfare cannot solve all the problems. You can't just be like, well, we're just going to stomp all over people who stomp on us, you know? I do love the mood before the battle with the boars, you know, before they're, like, totally routed. I love the music. Like, it's very tense. You can hear, like, a steady drum that gets louder, you know. Did you guys feel the same way?
I actually, music is one of those things for me that it's like editing. Like, I don't really feel it until it's super intense and in my face. I did notice a lot more of the mellower music in between that I enjoyed a lot. But music's just one of those things that, like, unless I'm focusing and I'm, like, really trying to dissect on a more technical aspect, it doesn't really pop up for me.
You know, I am kind of the same way. I really don't hear the music unless it's really good or it's multiple times that I've watched the film. But I must say, this movie, I don't necessarily referring to the scene that you're talking about, Mason, but the music overall, like, really struck me. And it was very creepy at times, almost horror-esque. And so that kind of, like, perked my ears up, because those aren't traditional keys and notes that you hear in animated films too often. But as I was watching this movie and listening to the soundtrack, definitely stood out in a good, very, very good way.
Yeah, totally. And the imagery of the pigs getting totally blown apart by the humans and their technology is just, it's sad. Even though the boars were dumb to just rush into battle like that, because they knew, you know, it's a trap. But man, it's just super sad, and the imagery is so striking. My gosh.
Mm-hmm.
Let's backtrack a bit, and let's talk about San and Ashitaka. Because as soon as San gets the chance, she wants to kill Ashitaka. She's just like the wolves.
Yeah.
You know, and what stops her? You know, why shouldn't I kill you right now? Because I think you're beautiful. I can't, is that what he says? I can't remember.
Yeah.
Like, you know, typical anime girl. oh, he likes me. Or you're like, I'm totally blown away. Oh, man. That's not to say that San's character is weak. It just obviously caught her off guard, and Ashitaka became a little more interesting to her. Mm-hmm. And so for some reason, she has pity on him and goes and heals him, and then there's that cool moment of the forest spirit, some crazy foreshadowing as Jigo is watching the whole thing and plotting the demise of the forest god. And then I love the super awkward beef jerky kiss when she realizes that he can't chew his food. It is very tender because he's totally touched by her sudden stroke of compassion for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a very powerful scene, but at the same time, I'm just like, ugh, easy, yeah. Mama bird.
She's feeding him. Yeah, she's feeding him like a tiny baby bird.
Oh,
cute.
Gosh.
And I think that's the only, and that's a significant scene because that's like the only time when Ashitaka is truly vulnerable. You know, mm-hmm. He's pretty capable in every other part of the film.
Mm-hmm.
What an archer.
Except for when the rage curse takes over his body. That's a different kind of vulnerability. But there is that one time I think he's riding the red elk and samurai come after him. He gets really angry and he starts, you know, using his bow and arrow and he like massacres their entire team.
I like how he shoots the one samurai's head off and then the other dude who was with him just like turns back like, nope.
Nope.
I'm going back. So awkward beef jerky kiss. And then we get some crazy drama with Moro is another tragic character who has accepted the fact that she will not survive the wound inflicted by this newfound power of Irontown, the bullet in her lodged in her chest. And it's very tough. And it's very tough on San because she realizes that her mother, you know, figure is slowly dying and that she has to accept it. And so San, I wouldn't call her naive, but she like, you know, she's not exactly a static character in this movie. She goes through a lot of growing and a lot of heartache herself, which factors into the ending between her and Ashitaka. But I liked the cool scene where Moro is like, you know what? I know that San likes you, but you need to leave because I don't like you. And if you come back, I'll kill you. You know, and Ashitaka, bound by honor, has to leave. And I like that concept. Especially in Japanese cinema. And then when Ashitaka wakes up in the morning and you know he leaves, I don't think he realized just how crazy his day was about to get because the samurai are attacking Irontown. The Irontown people are helpless because Lady Eboshi took a troop of warriors. Half of them are going to betray them, led by Jigo, the crazy monk. And they're going to go kill the forest god because the emperor wants his head or he won't buy the iron anymore. So everybody's in this like weird bondage of enterprise and, you know, and stuff like that. And it totally makes for a crazy finale for the film. And I won't even call it a finale because it lasts like an hour. And it starts with the horrifying imagery of a wounded Okoto being consumed by the demon. And is it me or those little pigskin assassin dudes really creepy? They're like the elephants from Dumbo. They're like the trippy hallucinogenic sequence of Dumbo.
Yeah.
We're boars. We're boar skins on parade. Here we come, clippity cloppity. They're here. They're there. What will I do? What an unusual view.
Oh, someone please make fan art of that. That's wonderful. Dun, 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 dun.
It can have Ashitaka and San looking around and the little pig dudes are dancing around them. I don't know why I find it so funny. Anywho. And so Okoto, a poor guy, is becoming consumed by the demon and then he tries to eat San. And so San is in, you know, she's up Poop Creek without a paddle, trapped, as it were. And so everybody is kind of clashing in this huge finale. I love the poetic justice of Lady Eboshi getting her arm gruesomely chopped off by the wolf. What did y'all think of that?
That was awesome.
Here's something to do. Here's something to do. Go either watch the DVD and go through the frame by frame of the scene of her arm getting bitten off, as the Lady Eboshi has this like smirk on her face. Like, it is not a grimace of pain, it's almost like a smile, because she immediately, when it happens, she understands the cruel irony, because she told her soldiers that even if he cut off the wolf's head, it can still bite, which I don't think is true in real life, but I'll just sip down that Kool-Aid. Her face is a smirk right after getting her arm bitten off. Like, it's kind of creepy how tough this lady is. And I just thought that was very powerful, because Eboshi is a very tough old lady. Holy cow. Also, side note, I like how back in Irontown, they're talking about the Emperor, and the ladies are like, oh, that's nice, who's he? They, like, couldn't care less who the royalty is or who the Emperor is. Anyway, thoughts on the finale. Myra, Morgan, I'm talking too much.
I know, but you're just so good at it.
Aren't I? Velvety voice, BYU Telefund.
Myra, go. Go.
Just general thoughts in terms of the end. I don't know. I honestly... Obviously, this is a really important film for Ghibli and everyone involved, and it definitely gets to the heart of very many fans. But unfortunately, because of the length and because of so many themes that he's dealing with, which surprisingly I felt like he got away with so many more themes in Spirited Away than he did with this. But there's just so much happening, and then it's just so. He takes his time with everything and all of the plot points and wrapping all of the stories up at the end, that by the time it gets to the end, I tend to lose a little bit of interest. Like I mentioned before, I have a terrible memory. So having so much information is really hard for me to retain. And the last thing I really remember at this point, being under pressure, so that, you know, get me some slack here, is just the fact that, you know, Ashitaka and Mononoke and San have that exchange where, you know, Ashitaka is like, yeah, dude, you know, I love you, I want to live with you, but I have to help out the humans. And San's like, well, you know, I can't go over there, so I guess this is what it's going to be. Which I found really interesting, and I thought was really nice, and it sort of has, you know, this modern look at relationships or what have you. Like, it's just a really interesting, not even a solution, just like a temporary band-aid on what was happening between the two of them, and taking a look at Ashitaka's honorable sense of wanting to just help everyone the best way he possibly could.
Definitely a bittersweet ending. And my last remarks on the climax of the film, or like this whole second act, is that things get weird. Things get really weird from the expression on the forest god's face when he gets shot, to the weird goop-de-goop, to the concept of total destruction, you know, total trial by fire. Although we do get to see Jigo show off his kung fu skills, which is cool.
That was the most impressive animation in the entire film, was for me anyways. Was when they were dealing with the forest spirit going in between the elk shape and the full on crazy mode forest spirit. It was really beautiful. Like, and just that entire forest section too, like when he could walk on water and you had the little patches of, like, I don't even know, green islands hanging out in between the water. Like, that was just really striking and really beautiful.
And I love the symbolism that with every step, plants grow and then they die in turn. And the awesome moment when you realize that the forest spirit did not heal Okoto or Moro. He took their lives and ended their suffering.
Yeah.
So it's a very, very mature look on the power of deity, or the concept of deity, that it is that they are givers but also takers away. And that's all part of their wisdom as far as deity goes.
Exactly. You hit the nail on the head there. Yeah.
Bravo.
So crazy. So crazy. I'm like learning. I'm like Zen mode, philosophy mode while we're recording this. So I can't, but honestly, last word, I can't think of on the climax. I can't think of a weirder ending to a Miyazaki film. I can think of more disappointing endings. I can think of more fulfilling endings, but I cannot think of a more weirder ending, or at least climax to the film.
True. Yeah.
Like giant mobile castle, I can dig. You know, it was the scarecrow the whole time. that's fine. You know, randomly figuring out it's my parents because of the ribbon on their ear, that's fine. But this is just crazy.
And it's all because of beheading. There were so many beheadings.
Oh my gosh, people, everything's in chaos at the end of this movie.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Which brings me to my point on the ending of the film, the resolution or quote unquote resolution of the film. I think the ending of the film was very disappointing, and I will tell you why. I was put off by Lady Eboshi's ending. My gosh, she got her arm torn off, but somehow she survives. And the first thing she says at the end of the film is, "Oh, we're gonna rebuild a better town." So she's just gonna go back and level the forest again, which magically returned. Like, I was totally prepared to accept the fact that nature had been so violated in this movie, and everything was so far gone that there was no healing for the forest. Mankind totally screwed it up. The forest gods screwed it up because of their arrogance. I'm getting all emotional here. And why did the forest have to come back magically?
Can I ruin the whole thing for you?
Please ruin it, because I need enlightenment here. My response.
Okay. Thank you. Studio Ghibli, I talk about the studio in general as a whole, because that's sort of how you have to take a look at all of the films. You have to take a look at them, what they represent at each section of, like, their history, if you want to look at it that way. But Studio Ghibli as a whole has always represented and has been known for, you know, being ecological-friendly films, where they always discuss, you know, the environment and, you know, how we as humans either hurt it or are trying to figure out our relationship with nature. And that is something that Miyazaki has sort of fought against or tried to figure out throughout the years. So in the beginning, he starts out really strong being for the environment, wanting to say, you know, we as humans have destroyed it and we need to put it back together. We need to realize the error of our ways.
Yeah.
When it comes to this film, he's matured this idea and he's realized that in his research and just in his everyday life, because he has two homes. He has a home in, you know, the heart of Tokyo, and he has a home in the outskirts in the wilderness. In the woods, whatever. The way he talks about it, he was just like, man, I'm like alone up there, and I just go about my day. I wash windows. So he's able to look at nature from both perspectives, both from being up in nature and being alone and just cohabitating, to also being in the city and, you know, wanting to take advantage of our modern age. I lost my train of thought.
But why does the forest have to just magically return?
You know, I don't have an answer for.
If mankind is supposed to rebuild, then... why?
I remember my tangent now. So I don't have an answer for why the forest has to magically rebuild. And it's not so much that the forest naturally is just going to go back to normal. It's that it's almost like our absence or us learning as humans how to cohabitate and literally share the space with nature and figure out what the balance needs to be. Mm-hmm. Is what he was aiming for. Yes, yeah. Irontown is going to be rebuilt, but so is the forest, and it's about learning how to give and take. It's a lot of that give and take. Yeah. So when he was looking at this film overall, he didn't want people to see the forest or nature as this delicate little creature anymore. It's not something that we as humans have just, you know, completely destroyed. It's actually something that we need things from nature. But we also have to remember to give back in order to keep receiving those things. And he goes a lot, like a lot of what's in the book pertaining to Princess Mononoke and Turning Point actually has to do with those ideas of, you know, how they as Japanese have leveled a lot of the forest, or, you know, sort of forced nature to work with them so that they can make rice paddies or, you know, tea farms or what have you. But also this idea that, you know, nature has also revolted against humans many a time. So nature's not delicate. Yeah. Nature's not delicate, but, you know, we as humans are also not delicate. So that's sort of thematically what he was trying to work with and put out there.
All right. Well, that clarifies a lot of it for me, but still, it's just... It, there doesn't seem to be a time except in the case of Ashitaka, when the humans really band together with the forest creatures and, like, you know, harmony, harmony.
Yeah, you're really pulling out some old school references. The Little Mermaid TV show. High five. Awesome.
Hey, high five, high five.
I'm in love. Like, not with you, but with your reference.
There's this overall theme of hatred in the film. The humans and the gods both refuse to compromise and learn to live with each other. I don't think they ever do. At the end of the film, the samurai hate Eboshi's people for some reason. The samurai are the only people who don't get redeemed in this movie.
Aren't they supposed to be more noble than anyone else? You know,
well, it's the irony.
Yeah.
It's the flipping the old stereotype of the noble, honor-bound samurai on its head, because they blatantly attack old women in this movie. I saw it. I think it's kind of like, hey, we need to stop living in the past of this, like, funky feudalism, colonialism, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I don't know. Are the samurai worse than Lady Eboshi? I think so, because they're a little more mindless. They don't have much of a conscience. But anyway, the samurai hate Eboshi's people. Eboshi's people hate San and her wolves. The pigs hate the humans, and the monkeys seem to hate everybody. Now, Ashitaka is the only one who has any sense in this bunch, who isn't consumed by hatred, at least not by default. And so Ashitaka is probably besides Jigo, Ashitaka is my favorite character because his purity makes him this very effective savior. In fact, I noticed that purity seems to be a common theme with heroes in Japanese lore or anime. I'm thinking most of Goku from the Dragon Ball series. It's dumb, but he is a symbol of purity.
Why is it dumb? Come on.
It's not, because I don't want to be people like, oh, Dragon Ball Z is a real anime.
what?
Well, it is.
I've never heard that.
It's kind of the epitome of anime.
It really is. Sometimes people roll their eyes when I talk about Dragon Ball Z, and I'm like, what?
That's for different reasons.
It's too mainstream.
A bunch of half burly, blonde, half-naked men, you know, grappling with each other. What's wrong with that, anyway? To where everyone questions. But anyway, back to Ashitaka. He's pure, and he wants to help everyone. He knows there can be a compromise, which causes people to stuff like, you know, just whose side is he on anyway, you know? And also, the wolf tribe never seems to get over their hatred for mankind, you know, evident in San's refusal to live with Ashitaka. And Ashitaka isn't like, okay, I'll go live with you. You seem cool. You know, he goes off and he kind of has this duty to help the humankind reheal. And by the way, I love Jigo's line at the end. He's pretty much like, you know what? F this. I give up. You guys are crazy. I'm gone. I'm not going to try this anymore. I'm like, yeah, good call, bro. Do not try to pull that stunt again and try to ruin everything. But I guess in the end, I just don't like how everyone in the film seems to be redeemed except for the people we're rooting for. Jigo gets to live besides being a jerk, you know, despite being a jerk. Eboshi gets to live, and she gets to tear down the forest again. So, like, I'm getting all worked up again, but that's just the only problem I have with this film is the ending.
Well, she doesn't get to tear down the forest again. I think she learns to cohabitate, because if you remember one quote I remember from this entire film.
Ooh.
I know.
It's going to be big, guys. Get ready. Wait for it.
It's from, I think it was the ox driver, and he says something like, whoa, the spirit forest makes the trees? I didn't know that, or something like that. See, I'm terrible at this.
That's
but he
right.
says something like that, and so there's a little bit of that realization. I think it's just a little bit of a seed into the audience consciousness that, you know, now they're aware, and it might change in the future.
Okay, so maybe there'll be a little, and there's probably listeners who are like screaming at their stereos now, like, "Don't you get it, Mason?" okay, now I see, because a little girl chant for you, a little ego raptor. But anyway, now I see that that the people in Irontown kind of understand that there is a symbiotic relationship. There is a circle of life, as it were.
Yeah, indeed.
Because they tear down the trees to build their buildings, but they also have to have better respect for these forest gods, for the spirit of nature, as it were, because, you know, they're the one that gives them the trees in the first place. So, okay, that's kind of coming together. So in the end, frustrating ending for me, but that doesn't detract from this film, because I really, really love it.
Well, one of the reasons that the movie kind of loses steam for me is the ending. But it was kind of like what Myra was talking about. It's just, there's so much that's piled on, and it's a lot to take in, especially at the very beginning. There's a lot of names, there's a lot of characters, a lot of situations, a lot of folklore that we're introduced to. And I think at just a point, it becomes really overwhelming, and I just sort of lose interest. I'm not as focused as I should be. I'm sort of just taking it in rather than, really in the moment, I know when I was watching it this time, I was distracted during the end, which is probably the pivotal scene, but, kind of playing Words with Friends on my phone at the same time. So, and that's very disappointing because it is a really good movie, but, it is what it is.
Yeah. And the ending was very abrupt.
Yes.
It was like, here's your head back. We're all fine now. Dun, 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 dun.
More credits.
Yeah. I do like that there are bazooka-toting people in this movie. I also think it's ironic that the Japanese were the first to develop gunpowder, but, whatever. I guess the guns aren't a huge symbol in this
movie. Hey, they realized, this was a mistake.
Also, general feeling of the movie is, I like how there's a lot of unexplained, legendary magic stuff that we're just supposed to kind of accept, Mm-hmm. Don't touch it! We have to perform this ritual, Yeah, it reminds me a lot of the writing in The Last Unicorn, how there's just a bunch of magic stuff that we're just supposed to kind of sip down and accept,
mm-hmm.
Which is crazy because, Last Unicorn was produced by a kind of a proto Studio Ghibli, as it were.
Yeah.
The studio, that studio eventually went on to be, Miyazaki's crew. Also, I keep seeing the Last Unicorn graphic novel at Barnes & Noble. I really want to get it.
Ooh, I bet it's really good.
Yeah, it is pretty good. The art is they expand on the art. Well, I flip through it. Goof isn't gallant. Gallant buys all his comic books before he reads them. Goofus sits in the comic book store and he reads them, and without paying for them.
There has never been a truer.
Goofus sucks. He's like the original Beavis and Butthead, but just one guy.
And very 50s.
Very 50s. Goofus does not use proper table manners. Gallant always pays respect to the patrons of his house, Anyway. So anyway, let's wrap this up, because I'm getting too emotional with how frustrating the ending was. Let's rate it, shall we?
We shall.
Okay, here we go. My rating, I'm going to give it 4 stars, because this ended up being my favorite Miyazaki film besides Spirited Away. To me, Spirited Away is perfect. You can never touch it. But Princess Mononoke is an epic, beautiful, beautiful art. As I said, Miyazaki is a master of his craft. The only problem I have is how too many characters got redeemed in the end. There needed to be some blood, people.
Well, there was blood.
There was plenty of blood. You're right. Okay, so 4 stars. What do you say, Morgan?
So I agree. I give this 4 stars. It's beautiful. The soundtrack was very interesting. I like the characters, and I like the themes that are presented in the movie. It's different than anything you would find in American animation, for sure. If something like this came out of an American studio, my jaw would, hit the floor, because it's just so uncommon. But and so for that reason, it's really refreshing, especially how violent it is and the blood. I mean, that's kind of been a theme with our reviews recently. It was like, smoking and gambling.
It's refreshing
cool.
How violent it is.
And the same thing with this. It's like violence. Ooh, we haven't seen much of that before. So, I like it. It really kind of is drawn out a bit too much for me. I think maybe if it was a bit tighter of a plot, especially towards cut some of the stuff in the middle to make a more streamlined ending, I would enjoy it more. So for that reason, I give it 4 stars.
All right, Myra.
So generous.
Let's hear it, Myra.
But you're like the super fan of Miyazaki, so I am. Are you gonna do a 2 stars?
No.
I'm okay with whatever.
Okay, just give us your rating and why. We're gonna be blown away. Just let us know.
Well, okay. So here's the thing. First off, with me and ratings, I hate giving ratings. I don't believe in ratings, just like I don't believe in grades. It doesn't mean anything to me.
What? Everything must be categorized and given a value, Myra. Don't you know that?
No, I don't believe in money. Like I'm in all seriousness, I don't believe in money. I use it, sure, but and that's an entire different discussion. Anyways.
All right, Pokemon.
Why didn't this come out earlier?
If it doesn't pertain to the film. Anyways.
Hey, I guess this means we don't have to pay Myra for this episode, Morgan.
Wait, you were going to pay me?
No.
Yeah, we pay all our guests, except
we,
for you.
We pay attention to them.
I don't really believe in ratings. I believe there are two big things that go into that should go into a rating, but people don't really realize this. One is there's a number that you give a film or whatever it is you're taking a look at, and it's either completely objective and you're looking at it as a work, you know, as a work of art or a work of whatever, and judging its quality. Then the second half is your emotional attachment to it and what it means to you and your nostalgia factor. Those two things, they do not go hand in hand. They cannot go next to each other. I love Kiki's Delivery Service. It is my favorite film out of the Studio Ghibli series, but I understand that it is not the one of the most quality. So that's my reason behind having two numbers. My numbers are, for Princess Mononoke, my objective number is a 3.5.
And
I'm being I'm being generous.
Okay.
My personal feeling towards it is more like a 2.75, like 2.75.
I don't think we've ever had a 2.75 star rating.
You guys
do they
are
even
not
have graphics for that, like on the website?
I don't think it's possible. No, yeah, I'm extremely extremely rough on everything that I'm forced to rate. Like it just I believe that the studios have a certain responsibility, which most of the time, especially Studio Ghibli, I feel Studio Ghibli does fulfill a lot of the responsibilities. But it just, in terms of, you know, getting me to fall in love with this film, it didn't really do it for me. I think it's a great film, and it's a great testament to their legacy, and a lot of people love it, and I respect them for that, and I think they have solid reasons for it. It is a very important film because of its, you know, its relationship. It exposes our relationship with nature and all of the themes, and it's beautiful, but personally, it just doesn't quite do it for me.
Very interesting.
I love your opinions, and that sounds like someone that does. Sounds very demeaning. But I love your opinions, but
go
away as my old term. Just kidding. No.
And I'm fired.
I had to use it, you know. That's the episode title. Go away.
Do you realize that they'll come after you now, Myra? You'll be hunted by Miyazaki fans.
So, I was going to say, I love, like, your analysis behind a rating and how you broke it down and how you really detach yourself from, you know, nostalgia factor and, you know, objective. So I'm actually really, really surprised that, you know, as such a Studio Ghibli Miyazaki fan that you still are able to say detached, you know, even though I love the studio and everything they do, this is what I give it. And now I'm like, oh, I thought she would have been super excited to do this movie, but probably secretly when I told you doing this one, you were like,
I was just like, why this one?
Well, we'll bring you back on Kiki's Delivery Service. How does that sound?
That would be great because right at this point, I kind of feel like the general rotoscoping audience probably sees me as a girl who hates everything.
But you're the coolest person in the world.
They don't know that.
Oh, man.
Oh, wait, no. I do love the Book of Life. People do know that. Okay, so not so bad.
Into our voicemails. I'm really excited because we got 6 voicemails. 5 of them are reviews of Princess Mononoke. So let's go ahead and listen to the first one from Gemma.
Hi guys, it's Gemma, and I have to talk about Princess Mononoke. I don't know if you remember, but Princess Mononoke is so, so close to being my favorite Studio Ghibli film. But if I was judging the Ghibli films by which was the most well-made and the most influential, then Mononoke would absolutely be my number one, because this film, it's just a masterpiece, no way around it. It's a work of art. If you could stick this film on a wall TV in an art gallery, people wouldn't question it. Every shot of this film is beautiful, even in its most graphic scenes. The score is magnificent. This is my favourite Joe Hisaishi score. It can go up against some of the best American film scores. And I reckon that if you played any of Joe Hisaishi's scores to a stranger, they wouldn't know it was from Japan. It's just that accessible. But the film's not all just pretty visuals and pretty audio. There is substance to go along with this style. Such a mature and intricate story and message. All those naysayers who still believe animation is just for kids can have this film shoved right in front of their eyes and be proven wrong. In my opinion, if we're comparing it to Disney, then Princess Mononoke is Ghibli's Beauty and the Beast. And that's high praise.
Hey, Rotoscopers. I'm Dylan Mentis from Massachusetts, and I'm a huge, huge fan of your podcast. I listen to your episodes over and over again, and I'm always waiting for a new one. Over the past year, I've been diving into the world of Miyazaki, and it's been awesome, which is why when I heard you guys were doing Princess Mononoke, I got super excited. Just a week ago, I picked up the DVD because so many people were telling me, no Studio Ghibli collection is complete without a Princess Mononoke. So obviously I had to go pick it up, and having seen it now, I completely understand why. It's magical, dark, brooding, spiritual, and some of the most beautiful animation a Miyazaki film can offer. I also love the common Miyazaki themes of our relationship to nature and war. I love how everybody is asking the main character, well, what side are you on? What side is he on? Is he on the side of the humans, nature? He just wants peace with everybody. He just wants no hate. And I love how the movie shows that hate can lead to destruction and despair, and we just don't need it. I would like to end with thanking you guys for this podcast. Honestly, people in my life aren't that excited about animation half the time, so it's nice to have people who I know are just as excited about me about these things, and it's nice to have an outlet and hear discussions in detail about these things where many people probably would just be bored of me. So, thank you.
Hi, Rotoscopers. It's me, Frank. Just here leaving my first voicemail. Just wanted to say how much I enjoyed your guys' podcast. So as far as my question about Princess Mononoke, were you guys just surprised by the amount of violence and blood in the movie? I know this is anime, which is a lot different from Western animation, but I never consider Miyazaki to be that type of director that shows that amount of violence and blood. Anyway, just wanted to get you guys' opinion. Love the podcast. Thanks.
Okay, what do you guys feel about the violence? Shocked by the violence?
Violence. I did think it was crazy that a Disney-distributed animated film would have so much violence. I mean, I have seen animes that have, you know... The violence in this film wasn't gratuitous. It was graphic, and it was shocking. But it wasn't like... It wasn't anything like Kill Bill. But, I did think it was weird for, like, a Miramax-distributed, film that Disney attached its name to. So, yes, I did think it was weird, but I guess it had to have served a purpose at some point. Right?
Right.
I definitely think it did. I actually don't feel that taken aback by the violence as some of you guys might have felt. I actually feel it's kind of appropriate. And I think, like I was talking about responsibility and how Studio Ghibli takes that very seriously. And it was mentioned in the articles, but it's just something that I've sort of observed in their repertoire, which is the fact that, you know, they don't treat their audience as if they can't handle certain things. Like they think their audience is mature enough, at least, you know, intellectually, whether they're talking to directly to children or teenagers or adults, they feel like they can handle certain things. This film in particular was, originally, when he was making it, he didn't really have a specific demographic he was going after, and it was only till later that he was like, oh yeah, maybe, you know, middle school children or older would probably be more comfortable with it versus, you know, children, 10 and under, let's say. But I think he thinks his audience can take it, And I definitely don't think that this film doesn't go too far with the violence. I don't think it steps over that invisible line that a lot of people would take offense to. But that's my personal take on the violence in this film.
Hi, Rotoscopers. This is Eric Faulkner. I've got one question about Princess Mononoke. Where's the Blu-ray?
Yes. It's coming out this year, isn't it?
I don't know.
Oh,
hopefully.
Man. Can you think of the screen captures from that movie?
So, yes, where is the Blu-ray? I just went to blu-ray.com, and it doesn't seem to even have any record that it's coming out yet. But my rest isn't coming out later, so I'm going to hold her to that.
Oh, man, really? I thought there was an article that maybe that was a different one. Don't hold me to it. Don't hold me to it.
Wishful thinking.
Now I have to look up all my articles. I did look up the Princess Mononoke thing. I guess what had happened was I remembered an article for a Blu-ray release in Japan, which is, I think it was supposed to happen last year. So you can definitely get the Japanese version. And I know they do have the Japanese versions in like the Barnes & Nobles or whatever your local stores. But for American release, yeah, maybe not so much.
Okay, so now we have two more voicemails that are not related to the film, but they're just fun. So first one's from...
Oh, this guy?
The first one's from... We'll keep it a surprise.
Well, hey there, Rotoscopers. This is Hank Hill, Strickland Propane. I just wanted to thank you for mentioning my dog, Ladybird, on your recent internet radio program. She's a real sweet dog, I tell you what. Bull! Dang it, Bobby, take that wig off. Oh, look what you made me record, son. Oh, I gotta go, Rotoscopers.
Yo, man, tell you what, man. That dang old hog dogs go to heaven show with a great chow. He and the dang old leech goes, ghost on that fleas, man. And the dang old big alligator shows up and goes, let's make music together. It's real funny, man.
I think you guys are amazing, and I love your website, and I love your videos, and I love everything of the Rotoscopers. Yeah, and that's it.
Oh, thank you, Yuri. We love getting voicemails. Glad you really like the show, and thanks to everybody above who, like Dylan and Frank, who were talking about and giving compliments about the show. It totally makes my day to hear people say that, you know, they feel like they have. Not feel, but they have animation friends that they can relate to and they can talk to animation about, and we can all, you know, make music together. Oh, that was so wrong. I was saying that because of the Paul Dogs Go to Heaven.
Shut her off.
Okay, let me see. I'm really glad that we have animation friends in our podcast community and on the website that we all get together, because trust me, people don't understand us. So thanks, guys.
Yeah, it's great to commiserate together as animation fans that no one understands. Let me just say that we have the best fan base ever. Like, honestly, I love our fans. Mm-hmm. Like, on the website, you can always count on like, sometimes we have, like, tons of comments. Example A being all of Myra's articles. But for the most part, all the discussion on the site is so respectful and very decent. And I just love it. I love being part of this. I never thought when we recorded on Beauty and the Beast that we would have a community kind of to discuss these animated films. And so I think it's really special. And Yuri, we love you too. We love you back. You're honorary fan of the day.
Okay, so we have three emails today. Two are Princess Mononoke reviews, and another one are thoughts from All Dogs Go to Heaven. So the first one is from Gemma. So this is the same Gemma who just sent us a voicemail. She was so excited. I was talking to her earlier. She'd already written this long review, so I'm excited to read it.
You have to read it in a British accent.
Hi, guys. I know I've already sent a voicemail, but I'm sorry. I just have to talk about Princess Mononoke.
Wow, you're good.
I love Gemma's accent.
10 points for Slytherin.
So you don't have to read this out because it's long. Well, we're doing it anyway because we love you. It is really a special movie. It's so it's unbelievable how much ambition and hard work was put into it. This was Miyazaki's baby. He invested so much into this movie. I'm pretty sure he invested himself a lot in his other films, too. But because this one feels much larger and more epic, there's a lot more passion put into it. And it shows on the screen. Coupled with the fact that Miyazaki looked over every frame and redrew half of the entire film himself. It almost reminds me of how invested Walt Disney was in making Snow White. He was so intent and obsessed with the project, it had to be perfect. Well, nothing can be perfect, but Mononoke came close. Mononoke is also special because it's an end of an era for Ghibli. It's the last traditionally hand-painted film they made before we get the marriage of traditional animation with digital coloring of the Ghibli films and anime in general today. So it looks and feels old-fashioned, in a good way, almost like how The Little Mermaid looks before Disney started using the cap system. But Princess Mononoke is still a hybrid of traditional and digital animation, and Ghibli's first use of CGI. It's barely noticeable. I can hardly notice it, but it's still an interesting note. I've really gotten into anime this year, and I've seen all the Ghibli films. This is the one film that I don't feel bad watching with the dub, because the dub is considered one of the best dubs ever made for an anime. Neil Gaiman gets everything across where another writer wouldn't. And there's rarely any moments where added unnecessary dialogue where there would be silence in the original, which happens quite a bit in Disney dubs for Ghibli. The voice acting is great, too. I don't see a problem with anyone. And unpopular opinion, I really like Claire Danes as Sam. Yeah, the general opinion is no one likes Claire Danes as Sam. She really gets the aggression across and plays Sam in a more immature character than the original. So I feel a lot better watching the dub because it's so faithful. And in the original, Moro is voiced by a guy, and it's weird. I'd also like to add there's a three-part documentary series on YouTube on the making of Princess Mononoke. I've yet to see it all because it's roughly 6 hours long altogether. Hopefully it won't be taken down before I get to finish. Here's the link. I'm looking forward to hearing the episode, and keep up the great work. Thanks, Gemma.
This next email is from Suzanne. She says, "Hi, Rotoscopers. As you know, I'm a big fan of everything you do, and I'm very, very happy that you listened to my many requests for another Ghibli movie episode. Yay!" Well, Suzanne, this is that's the only reason why we even did this episode, is because you suggested it. "I love Princess Mononoke," she says. "The music, the story, the visuals, the themes, the characters. It's a masterpiece. Every time I watch the intro, hear the narrator's voice, and see the mist above the forest, I get goosebumps. I just love how Ghibli films depict nature. It's so beautiful and mystical. Typically Ghibli, none of the characters are just good or just evil. Even though I love Disney and Pixar, I have to say that no Western animated movie has yet reached the depth and believability of Ghibli's characters. And there are especially strong female characters, even though the focus of the film is not a love story. The only reason that it's not among my top favorite Ghibli movies is that it gets really crazy and violent towards the end. It fits with the story. In the end, it is a war between humans and nature. It has to be dramatic. It's just not something I want to watch all the time. But on another note, I do want to listen to the soundtrack all the time. One of Ghibli's best. So thanks again for reviewing this movie, and I can't wait to listen to the podcast. Please, please, please also review My Neighbor Totoro, Whisper of the Heart. I promise it's better than its title. It's really good." She says, "And Kiki's Delivery Service. Keep up the fantastic work, Suzanne."
I am all over those three titles. Whisper of the Heart is actually really, really good. I agree with her, and totally underrated.
Sheesh, I've never even heard of it.
Well, you know, if you lived in a tiny little place called Manhattan, Brooklyn, New York, you'd get to see them at the annual Studio Ghibli Festival at the IFC Theater. Just throwing that out there, people.
Ooh, fancy.
So this next one comes from Chris, and it's in regards to All Dogs Go to Heaven. "Hi, Rotoscopers. I was 12 when this film came out. I sort of knew what Mardi Gras was and the setting of the film itself, which I suppose didn't confuse me as much as I sort of wondered, what kind of world was this where dogs had this seedy underbelly separate from humanity to do their wills in? Certainly far more detailed than what I might get out of a Disney film previous. It's true how this film got plenty of flack back in its day, often for its darker scenario concerning the kidnapped girl being used by the dogs as a gambling device. I recall having read many reviews for the film back in 89 that painted it such a bad color in that respect. It's true there was a lot of things either edited out or altered by the film by the time the film reached theaters. Once I recall is Killer trying to use a Flash Gordon subatomic ray gun that was originally going to be a real Tommy gun in the original script, and it was animated that way before they had to change the animation after a test screening. At least we get a gun at all. And while some have stated the word stupid was uttered in the film, I only recall Scarface call his subordinates morons. I'm surrounded by morons. While it is true they couldn't get Burt to promote this film at all, and what with Judith Barcy's death, that is kind of a letdown. Nothing was ever mentioned of it in its release. Dom DeLuise was plucked to do a short piece that opened and closed the original VHS release, reminding viewers of the Boys and Girls Club America as some sort of consolidation, I suppose. Well, true, a lot of the artwork has been lost over time. Many pieces have popped up on eBay in recent years. I snapped some pics of cells from the collection I was glad to get for good prices, including a studio Christmas card from after the production wrapped up. By the way, here's a quick vid of the Sullivan Bluth studios from around 1988, and he posts that link, and he says, thanks again, Chris.
Okay, thank you so much for your review, Chris. I loved hearing your thoughts, and holy cow, the fact that you have own cells from this movie, like, makes me just really, really jealous of you, because, you know, like we talked about, there is nearly nothing of this film available, so the fact that you own some is pretty special and exciting. And now I'm going to have to definitely check out eBay, because I want to own some too. Go. We want to thank everybody for listening to this episode of the Animation Addicts podcast, and especially our special guest, Myra, for joining us and for contributing her amazing knowledge of Studio Ghibli and her somewhat occasionally controversial opinions, which we love.
Well, it was my pleasure. I had a lot of fun. I hope my information thoughts were insightful as well as entertaining. You have to have both, but it was great being here. I'm so glad you guys had me on.
You are welcome. I'm glad you could join us. Okay, so when you're tweeting about this episode on Twitter, make sure to use the hashtag AnimAddicts and use the hashtag GoAway also. So that way we know that you got to the very end of the episode. And double points if you use them together. For show notes, make sure to go to rotoscopers.com/69. You can also find us on Hypable and Animated Views. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and also Stitcher Radio and anywhere good podcasts are found. Be sure to leave us a review in iTunes if you haven't already. We love getting reviews, and they really help more than you know. If you want to have your voice heard on the show, be sure to send us a voicemail at rotoscopers.com/voicemail, or you can call in at 406-646-6575. Those last four numbers stand for Roto. All right, so our next episode is going to be Tarzan, because by the time this episode is released, it will be a special birthday present from the Rotoscopers to Mason for his birthday. This is the episode that he wanted to do, so happy birthday, Mason, prematurely.
Aww.
So get your voicemails ready for that, because it's going to be awesome.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. This has been a stellar episode, having Myra on the show. We're just tickled to have her on the podcast today, and definitely brought some awesome content to the show. So thank you for being here, Myra. Also, Myra mentioned the Miyazaki like documentary biography books, which are Starting Point and Turning Point. And so, if what follows is an excellent way to support the podcast, and that is through our Amazon affiliate link. So we're going to set up some links in the show notes to go through our Amazon affiliate link and check out these books. They will be amazon.com/startingpoint and amazon.com/turningpoint. What's going to happen is you will be able to shop for these books, check them out on Amazon, while supporting the podcast because it goes through our Amazon affiliate link. You can't lose. So check out those links when this episode comes up. And you can find us at our individual Twitter locations, Morgan Stradling, at Morgan Stradling. You can find me on at Mason, SMTX, on Twitter. Also, thisanimatedlife.blogspot.com. I've got some new stuff up, and I've also revamped the template of the website so it doesn't look like barf. So check it out. And Myra's Twitter handle is at Amaya Sun Wizard. So at Amaya Sun Wizard to find her on Twitter. And trust me, it's worth it to follow all these awesome people. Again, thank you so much for listening. We love you guys, and we love animation. Until next time,
we are the Rotoscopers.
Certified.
Sorry, I didn't know that.
Hey, listen, this way!
Alright, let's talk some distributed... Gosh. Morgan.
Sorry. Donde estamos?
The title.
Way down here.
La princesa Mononoke.
Okay. In the fact that, you know, you are, of, you know, the customs of our country and our, not our country, but, you know, the customs of our organization. What is it, guys? A clan?
Clan? I was going to say clan.
Village, organization.
Village, okay.
Yeah.
I kept saying clan, but then I didn't actually say it. So it was like, blah, 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 blah. Okay.
Oh, what's her mom, wolf mom, god name? Mora, Moan?
Again, with the names.
Mona. God, I gotta go back to IMDb.
I'm flipping through my book.
Oh, I keep typing Spirited Away. let's see. Princess Mono. No, okay. Mono, no. Okay. Let's see. Moro.
I only have one thing to say to you, Hank, and you, Boomhauer. Is that my lawnmower has a watertight seal. I can mow my lawn in a hurricane. Can you mow your lawn in a hurricane, Bill?
No.
Can you mow... can't even do it. Here's the deal, Hank, is that there's a conspiracy against the government. I mean, the government is the conspiracy.
Okay, that was the best King of the Hill impression I've heard.
That was impressive.
That was really good.
That was the best Boomhauer I've heard, too. Oh. He really brought the inflections of Boomhauer's voice.
What are you talking about? I thought it actually was Hank Hill and Boomhauer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Way to ruin it.
Right, it was.
Dang it, Father. That's like my favorite. I quote that whenever something crappy happens or someone does something wrong. I'm like, gosh, dang it, Bobby.
Dang it, Bobby, what are you listening to? It's Radio Disney, Dad. Have you seen that episode? Anyway. Oh, that's awesome. Mike Judge. Yeah.
Contributing her incredible confrontational, not confrontational, term I'm thinking of.